Woohoo! Welcome to the Some Work All Play podcast. We are so happy to be with you today.
And I'm so pumped because it's David's birthday today, we get to share this podcast and David's birthday with everyone. And I think I love your birthday way more than you do.
Yes. You woke up this morning and you were just so bright-eyed and bushy-tailed about my birthday. And I'm like, can we celebrate literally anything else? I'm sure there's some like national day of, we can just make it up. It's like the national day of corn dogs or something.
I used to give into that when we were first dating and then first married. And now I'm like, no, we are celebrating your birthday. This is going to be an awesome day. It's going to be different. It's going to be fun. And you've kind of acquiesced, but we still have some pushback.
You know how to get me like super crunk, which is telling me I have a birthday workout.
I'll give you a diabolical birthday workout this morning.
Yeah. So Megan gave me my birthday in minutes. Am I out to, does a boy tell about his age?
You may tell.
Okay. 33 by 1 minute efforts with 1 minute easier recovery.
That sounds really diabolical. It's 33 by 1 minute fartleks. I feel like when you add fartleks compared to efforts, there's like a slight change in like tone shift and expectations. Do you feel that?
I don't know about that. I feel like either one just has like, things are coming out of every orifice during that
probably
type of workout.
But you smashed it. You looked so good.
Well, it's so fun. Actually,
it's your birthday. You banged it.
I banged it?
You banged that workout.
Oh my gosh. Speaking of orifices. It was super fun. It's definitely the way to get me hyped. And I really appreciate it. It actually reminds me of a quote that was in an athlete's log that I think is relevant for right now. It was my daughter's birthday and we had a quote, Pizzagate. Made 7 of her 8 birthday guests cry by serving pizza with olives.
And
had all the parents frantically scraping the pizza. I fucking crushed it.
That is amazing.
That's some parenting swag.
That
I love it.
That is hardcore parenting swag. Also, I'm wondering who that one child was that loved the olives.
Seriously,
did you think about that in there?
That child's going to be like, I don't know.
So sophisticated.
Yeah.
I love it.
The restaurant reviewer for sure for the New York Times.
Actually, it's funny though, because we had a smoothie gate today. So I had an appointment this morning. So you had to get out for your workout early. You came to the appointment with me. It was awesome. And then afterwards, I'm like, David, it's your birthday. Let's go get a birthday smoothie. Let's go to Rush Bowls, which is like my favorite place in Boulder. You've never had it. I was like, it's time to break your Rush Bowl virginity. And you were not pleased at all. You're like, Megan, I have to work. It is a work day. It's a Tuesday.
it's a Tuesday first and my birthday second.
And I was like, no, it's your birthday first and a Tuesday second.
Well, the ultimate celebration to me is getting to record this podcast with you every week. So it's perfect that it falls on my birthday. And it is our 1 year anniversary episode. So
happy anniversary, boo.
Yeah, woo.
High five.
High five. 52 weeks ago, we started this. There's 54 episodes because we did 2 weeks.
We got really ambitious in 2 weeks.
Of two episodes.
Early on.
Yeah. Our plan all along has been to do bonus episodes.
And it still is our plan.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about that because
the trajectory of this plan is not looking good.
So the outline is currently open on Megan's computer. I'm counting maybe 27 windows open right now.
That's pretty good for me. As long as it's not in the 50s, I'm happy.
What do you need? There's no way you're going back to those windows in the future. Also, whenever she has her email dings on, it sounds like someone, like one of those little children are playing the cymbals at a...
It's like electronic dance music with email sounds.
Yeah, exactly. There's definitely some EDM going on. But we just wanted to say how much we appreciate all you. This is so cool that we're still doing this and it's succeeded beyond our wildest dreams.
And we're learning so much from our listeners. I mean, it's pretty wild, actually. Like the emails that we get from listeners, like educating us, just being positive, being awesome, being vulnerable.
Yeah.
Like it's been really eye-opening. And I think it's been a big fuel to why we've like kept these Tuesday podcast recording sessions going every week.
It's the coolest thing to do this with you. And, you know, last year at this time, we started with very first episode with 10 minutes on Black Lives Matter and the importance of that sort of social issue. And I feel like the world is in such a different place now, still immense, infinite amounts of growth to go, but like we just celebrated Juneteenth.
I mean, Juneteenth was such a cool celebration.
Yeah.
I think like for me, seeing like more and more people just like posting about it and like being excited about it. Actually, I had an athlete who spelled Juneteenth via Strava art in the streets of Washington, D.C., which was
like
impressive.
With their GPS?
With their GPS.
Wow.
It was also a fast run too. I was like, that takes some like grade A planning.
Yeah. And so that's the coolest thing. Still so much work to go.
Actually, we talk about here on here all the time about like little actions. And I love breaking down like, what are the little actions I can do each day? But I feel like next year when Juneteenth rolls around, like make it a big deal.
Yeah.
Like, cause I think like, you know, elevating this holiday and elevating like what it means and its purpose and the education behind it is so valuable.
Yeah, and what we all can do in every little thing that we have. Also, it's Pride Month, which is fucking awesome. And, you know, we were talking before this that looking at some of the stats that the Transgender Athlete Rights or Human Rights podcast episode is our most listened to ever.
Which makes me so happy. Yeah. If anyone could listen to one episode, it would be that one just because of like the importance of the message.
And I feel like we're having just immense leaps of growth in that area.
But I hope, you know, I hope in 5 years we look back on that and are like, we've established a new norm, you know, trans women are women, trans men are men. And I think like, I have a feeling we will say that and look back and say, why did we even have to record
and
that podcast?
All LGBTQI people are seen and loved. Actually, it's very relevant because when we went to Rush Bowls today, there was some graffiti, some street art outside that said, because of you, I made it through. And then you was crossed out and written over it in rainbow letters. Because of gays, I make it through.
I loved it. Also, it was a poetry building. It was like an abandoned poetry building. And I felt like I was like, what great way to decorate a poetry building. That's awesome.
Yeah. So
also too, we're moving past COVID. When we first started this podcast a year ago, like we were in the thick of COVID and, you know, social distancing and being like, when is the world going to open back up again?
Yeah. And today when we went to your appointment, we had to find masks and we're like, where are our masks?
What have we done with all of our masks? Actually, we ate inside a restaurant this weekend and like the bar was crowded and it just was like such like a beautiful welcome of like life coming back again. And like, so cool to see like how we've changed and adapted.
Yeah. And almost all my masks currently are now covered in ketchup. So I might need to restock because like there are some places where I'm going to want to wear masks in the future. Like, I don't know if I'm ever going to need to go on a plane sans the mask. So I need something that doesn't have like ketchup or mustard on it. So we've also been incredibly inspired by the Olympic trials.
I'm so inspired by the Olympic trials. I've been like nerding out. I'm like planning our dinners around races. We're having TV dinners so we can watch the Olympic trials. It's pretty awesome.
And the first thing we wanted to highlight is Grayson fucking Murphy.
Okay, what a race.
Yeah, so in her steeple, 3K steeple prelim, not only did she win the prelim, she went under the Olympic standard. And that last 100 meters, she had like rockets in her shoes.
It was so fast. So she went flying across the finish line. And I was pretty sure, so she did one of those things. Like a lot of athletes like fall and crumble at the finish line, especially steeple. Steeple is like the pinnacle of carnage in track.
Yeah.
And she just kept, I was like, Grayson, you don't have another lap. Like she probably added on an extra 80 meters of like full speed after that finish line.
Yeah, and Grayson is not a steepler, just a steepler, or just a track runner, or just a trail runner, or just a world mountain champion. She's all of those, plus an awesome writer, an awesome person. She just brings it all. And it's like a reminder to embrace all of our identities. She's been through ups and downs and through it all. She's just maintained that spirit. And actually it reminds me.
I've been super like honest and authentic about like her mental health journey and the things that she's dealt with and vulnerable. And I think to me it's just really inspiring to see this like athlete with this person with so many different identities be vulnerable and open up in that
way. And I remember last year around this time, she did a two minute toe intervals. And on Strava, I clicked on it and her grade adjusted pace was 4 minutes, 30 seconds per mile on those intervals with a progression at the end. And I remember saying to Megan, that is an Olympian workout because it was,
you have been calling.
I've never seen
so long.
I've never seen anyone do that without being able to run under a 15 minute 5K. Like she has everything within her already. And it's going to be so exciting to cheer on the final, but no matter what happens in the final, her entire future is just going to be bonkers fun.
And just the progression that she showed, she has to be so proud of that and like what she's put out there and put out into the world. Okay. But talk about another really cool athlete story. So we've also been getting into the sprints recently too. I feel like some of the athlete stories behind like the sprinters and just like their overall vibes. Sha'Carri Richardson.
Yes.
What a life force of a human.
Like everyone else, we are pretty much obsessed with Sha'Carri Richardson. I want to approach everything in life like her. So on the,
if you need like a pump up, listen, go and like watch the 15-second clips they have of Sha'Carri Richardson looking like hyped as fuck before getting ready to race.
They had a montage of her just in the warm-up area like 2 hours before her race. She is swag. She is like smiling at the camera, winking, like just bringing it in such a way that I'm like, that's exactly what everyone needs to do. I, you know, obviously she's one of the greatest athletes in the world, but if we can bring that energy to the podcast, to like if you're writing, to like first dates, to whatever, anything becomes possible.
Big Sha'Carri energy.
Oh,
I'm
man.
All about that. All about that. But what I love, so she won the 100 final. She's going to the Olympics. So awesome. She did, I mean, so she ran this race and then immediately after she took the stairs of the stadium, like three at a time to go see her parents and, or to go see her grandmother and give her just like this giant hug. And it was such a cool reflection on like her story and just everything that she's been through. And I think what's interesting about it too is that like we see these stories on TV, but there's so much more backstory to those stories. And I feel like when athletes highlight that and are authentic and vulnerable about opening up, it actually like really showcases that.
Yeah, and so, I think one thing we always focus on is the thrill of victory. It's like they put everything into these events and it works out. How cool is that? But on the flip side, often it doesn't. Like the whole idea, this is like the bar exam, but your entire life athletic future is on the line. And that can fucking suck at the same time. And there's so much that goes into all of this that we're not seeing that isn't just like a trip to Tokyo or anything.
We see in athletes like for Sha'Carri, we saw her like, you know, fast 100 meter performance. We saw her like, you know, her 3 minutes of celebration after, but there's so much that goes into that. And I think she actually had a really great quote on this topic. She said, "I'm still here. Last week, finding out my biological mother passed away and still choosing to pursue my dreams, still coming out here, still here to make the family that I do still have on this earth proud. And the fact is, nobody knows what I go through. Everybody has struggles, and I understand that. But you all see me on this track, and you all see the poker face I put on, but nobody but them and my coach knows what I go through on a day-to-day basis."
Yeah, and that's the idea, is that we can never know exactly what's going on in someone's life. And so when you see these sports are so cool because it distills it all into this one moment of performance, especially Olympic trials. This is 5 years in the making for a lot of these athletes, but we're not seeing like everything that goes into it. And so if you're doing that in your own life, like if people are only seeing a little snippet of it, like cut yourself slack, give yourself grace, and give others grace to know that there is so fucking much beneath the surface. And it can be really hard, even in the triumph. Like even the people that triumph can be like Sha'Carri can be going through the hardest difficulties of their life at that time.
I think the other thing too about the trials is there were so many notable names of people who were not included on that list. I mean, you talk about there was Drew Hunter was missing, Molly Huddle, Evan Yeager, Shannon Roberry, Colin Quigley, Kira D'Amato. Like all of these all-star athletes couldn't make it to the start line. And that's not their fault.
Yeah.
Like, it's very typical. Like when you're putting yourself out there as an athlete, like shit is going to happen.
Yeah.
Like when you're training at this top level, when you're training at any level, shit is going to happen. And I think like sometimes when it happens to us, it feels like the world is crashing down. The world
For
is
sure.
watching. And in reality, it's like, we just acknowledge these situations and move on as the world.
Yeah. It's like an hour or two of recognition.
Of like commentary on Let's Run about where's Drew Hunter? And then the world moves on.
And meanwhile, that's like definitional to someone's life. And it just points out that like, it's not about the whatever ends up happening. It's about the getting vulnerable in the first place. So, you know, whatever the metaphor is in your life, whatever the Olympic trials are, go for that shit. Like go for it as hard as you can. Show up, swag like Sha'Carri. And then if it doesn't work out, you know, your life moves on and it will be just as awesome. In fact, it'll be more awesome because you did that. Like I always try to remind myself of that because I would just be the type of person that doesn't make that leap, that doesn't take
doesn't
that chance.
Doesn't make the smoothie bowl leap.
Oh yeah.
Bringing it back.
Exactly.
Stirring the pot over here.
Yeah, stirring that smoothie
bowl. I think the other thing that I've thought about with the Olympic trials is just like fully internalizing and feeling the stories of those athletes. So I think I'm always the person, like if there's a Super Bowl blowout and everyone wants to go home, I'm like, no, wait, we need to watch the celebrations. We need to watch the families come onto the field. We need to watch the trophies. And I feel like for me, it's like investing that extra like 5 or 10 minutes into watching like the follow-up celebrations, watching the interviews that really gives life and meaning to those athletes. And I feel like for the Olympic trials, just like really embracing
that. It's all about the human story. I remember after the Saints got eliminated from the playoffs, Drew Brees went down to the field with his kids and just threw the football because it was going to be his last game. And he knew it was going to be his last game. And that's what it's about, is like the story of Drew Brees, not whether Drew Brees won a Super Bowl, which he did, but like the idea there is who gives a fuck, really?
I was tearing up watching. So we've been watching the swimming trials and I know nothing about swimming. Like literally this comes from the person, like I was thrown into a pool at age six and sunk and was like, not going to be a swimmer. This is clearly not my calling. I found out very fast, but we've been watching the Olympic swimming trials and I like found myself in tears. So 15-year-old Katie Grimes qualified alongside Katie Ledecky in the 800. And it was just like so cool to see like their dynamic and like the mentorship and of Katie Ledecky to Katie Grimes and the whole like dynamic of the interview. And I was like getting teary, knowing nothing about swimming.
And as she was being interviewed, Katie Grimes, the 15-year-old, was like, it's a lot of work.
I thought that was a pretty accurate representation of sports.
In that statement, I think I could see so much. I could see so many 30-plus hour training weeks that swimmers have to do.
At age 15.
Yeah, yeah. And to think about the psychological impact of that, both good and bad, in that every athlete is kind of going through that up and down where their livelihoods depend on this bones and gristle and stuff we don't control. And how fucking scary is that? And that's, so with the swimming trials, it's been very fun because we don't really know the backstories that much. So.
Actually, also talk about swimming. I really have no idea what's going on. And it seems really weird to me. Why are we swimming in so many different positions? It doesn't make sense to me. Like backstroke, who invented backstroke?
It is pretty wild to look at. For me, breaststroke is the one that I don't quite get. It's like, wait, why are we impersonating a frog now? I'm not really on board with this. I don't understand. I'm sure there's a good reason.
Oh, this is probably so nuanced. Yeah, I'm coming in from like the perspective of someone who sunk in the pool at age 6.
Exactly.
But I'm like, to me, it's like, are we going to run backwards on the track? Could that be like a thing? Could we have like a running track backstroke? I don't know.
Seriously, we should just have different, we should invent different types of running forms. Like that should be the SWAT podcast. Like to get to like Paris 2028 or whatever the thing is, like maybe straight arms. No one ever did straight arm running. Why not?
Like that sounds like the breaststroke of running.
Yeah, yeah. Our mascot is a T-Rex because T-Rex have little bent
very
arms.
True.
But maybe we need a mascot that has straight arms. I don't know. Like zombies are really underrepresented on the track. Let's get that out there. So we also wanted to do a doping follow-up, a little bit of a deeper dive into some of the doping issues right now. Because
I think it's been a fascinating point brought up, and it brings out a lot of questions about like testing, systemic issues. Like what are we facing too in terms of like the next 100 years of sport?
Yeah, and a lot of people told us they really liked our brief discussion on it. So we're going to delve in a little deeper, try to hit some of the nuances here, because I think in the past with the doping conversation, with the cheating conversation, you have to be like, this is evil. Like you could never do this. When in reality, all of these issues are much more nuanced and there's a gray area. Usually most people are not sticking a freaking needle into their butt. And even those people deserve compassion. So we're going to start with a little bit of a discussion of baseball.
Bum, 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 baseball. David loves baseball so much.
This is your baseball minute. So we talked about the sticky substances on baseballs. Last week, the Major League announced intentions to completely enforce the ban on external substances. So even things like sunscreen that you would use to get a little bit better grip on the baseball, they're saying no way.
Which as a background, I mean, sunscreen has been used for decades
in
baseball. Like, I don't think like baseball has ever existed without players using sunscreen to help pitch the ball. But what I think is actually really interesting is it's like talking about the implications of this. Like when you make these regulations, like there's probably going to be like far-reaching consequences because you think about like the balls over time in baseball have become more slippery with age, as sport has developed and evolved. But now if players can't grip the ball, like what is that going to do to shoulder, wrist, elbow injuries as pitchers are trying
already
to pitch a slippery ball?
Tyler Glasnow tore his ulnar ligament and he was like, this is because I have to grip the ball harder, farther in my hand. Meanwhile, in Japan, they have a tackier ball just naturally. In the majors, they haven't had to use it. Like the major leagues hasn't created a tacky ball because the pitchers have been using substances.
But I guess my other question there too is like, are we just going to keep evolving like more and more creative ways in which like players are going to introduce gray areas into this conversation?
Oh, I'm sure.
Like I'm picturing players that are going to like grow their beards and grow these like mullets and rat tails so they can touch like substances in their hair and then put it onto the balls.
We're definitely going to have a return of the 1980s big greasy man that's going to take baseball by storm. And that gets to one of the problems. How do you actually enforce this? Will innocent people be caught up in it? And that's complicated, but there has been an immediate result even prior to enforcement. So on the weekend before they even started this, so velocity of a pitch and the spin rate of the pitch should go hand in hand. They're dependent variables. But for the first time ever, spin rate plummeted.
It had like a spin rate Great Depression. It was like seeing the graph was wild.
While velocity actually went up just a little bit. And that's a sign that, oh yeah, people have been using, it probably is the 70 to 80% number that you often hear thrown around.
But also, I mean, talk about like the mental health of players and the stress of players. Like if pitchers have relied on the substance for years and like it's pervasive throughout the MLB, like, and these pitchers are on multi-million dollar contracts.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm doing the math in my head about like how anxiety provoking this must be for athletes.
And the reason that we started with baseball is that this is like kind of an external substance that everyone uses. It's not quite as black and white with cheating is perhaps sticking a needle in your butt.
Also, the reason we start with baseball is because you love baseball and I love your love for baseball.
And that has
we've
been,
covered that before.
That has been your baseball 5 minutes.
3 minutes.
Yeah. And so the transition to the Shelby Houlihan story, which I think is a little bit more morally complicated. And so I think brings out some of these issues a little bit more clearly. So for those that don't know the background, in December, she was tested, drug tested, and she was notified in January that she was positive for 5 nanograms per milliliter of nandrolone.
Which is an anabolic steroid.
Yes. And so the complication here is that there was a 2000 study in the Rapid Communications and Mass Spectrometry Journal.
Okay. I love that there is a doping study in the Rapid Communications of Mass Spectrometry Journal, which is probably like, talk about clicks right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Their journal is probably seeing escalation
they
in the number of clicks.
They are blowing the fuck up.
They are blowing up.
Actually, I was thinking that a pickup line journal could be Rapid Communications in Ass Spectrometry.
Oh, shoot. Look at your science jokes.
Yeah. Your ass is 90 parts per billion. I don't know. Sexy as shit.
That's amazing.
But yeah, this study found that 310 grams of uncastrated male boar tissue can raise levels of nandrolone to 7.5 nanograms per milliliter 10 hours after consumption.
Okay, first of all, a few nuances there. This study was done in 3 participants, yeah. Which I feel like this is like the common echo that I have whenever we talk about studies on this podcast is like, where is our end? That it's 3 participants is really small. Those participants' levels also ranged, I believe it was around 3.5 to 7.5 as the max. And so we are basing this doping case off of 3 participants in a journal in the Rapid Communications and Mass Spectrometry. But also talk about, so I dove in, I got really excited about this. I was like, I want to do the research on this and like understand more about like uncastrated boar meat.
Of course, don't we all?
Don't we all? But the study methodology made me want to be a vegetarian. Let me read this to you. So this is a direct quote from the study methodology. A meal was prepared by a restaurant chef from boar kidneys, heart, meat, and livers, roughly 25% of each component by roasting and frying. Mm. Additional ingredients were vegetables, potatoes, and a light mustard sauce made from the frying juice.
Oh, yeah.
That is a very funny study methodology and also gross.
I don't know. It turns me on just a little bit.
I think so. This highlights a few points about like this burrito proposition that this might have been a thing. So one, it's uncastrated boar meat, which is extremely hard to find in the United States. And I think like whether that is existing at a food truck or not is speculative. Also, uncastrated boar meat, pig offal is gross from all of the studies and like
what
like,
people, say,
what
about
people
it,
yeah. say about it. And like, I think if you're able to consume like more than 300 grams of pig offal in a burrito, wow, I eat everything I think on the planet. And to me, that seems a little surprising.
Megan has been Googling a lot about pork burritos.
Actually, my Google history is like, do you want to be a chef for pork burritos? I've been interested by the science. I'm like, I want to learn.
I think your Google search results are sponsored by Nike. Nike Performance Labs that one. But yeah, so she was notified a month later, and that's where the pork burrito comes in. And so we wanted to highlight a few complications to start, because it's not just, we're making some jokes, but it's not just cut and dry. The first is the lab decision. So what the lab does. The lab can either make an adverse analytical finding, which is what happened, which is the worst case, or call it an atypical result. An AAF, it kind of sets the burden of proof for the athlete.
And remind me, so those decisions are often made by like one or a few individuals, like
at the lab.
At the lab. So it's not like this, like it's not like there's like a jury in this process of making the decision on which path it
exactly.
goes down.
And so there's a middle ground where she tested for not the lowest level, not the highest level, where there's some discretion involved. If this had been called an atypical result, we probably never would have heard of it. It would probably be explained away, though it's tough to know exactly. But that was not what happened. It was an adverse analytical finding. Next complication. She actually didn't order a pork burrito. She ordered a carne asada burrito based on the receipts, which is unfortunate for her case, I would assume.
Yes. But I think she did claim that they had flipped the burrito.
Yeah, yeah. And she said it was greasy.
And the greasy is consistent with pig offal, which is gross.
And then on the other side, there are tons of character witnesses on her behalf.
Jerry Schumacher is, and we don't know Jerry Schumacher or Shelby, but both of them are apparently fantastic humans.
Yeah, and especially her coach is told by anti-doping crusaders is really respected and all that. That being said, in his statement, he said he didn't know what nandrolone was, which is a complication because a lot of coaches probably know that. But
I feel like I also feel like even if you don't know what nandrolone is, I mean, if you coach Olympic and world level athletes, like Marion Jones was doping on nandrolone, I feel like it is actually your responsibility to understand how the system works and to understand what is nandrolone.
And also, and volunteering that information without a need to volunteer that information also kind of weird.
It seemed a little sketchy to me.
But that being said, that's just all circumstantial. We don't even have the decision yet.
I think the other complicating fact here too is that Shelby doesn't even wear the Dragon 5 spikes, which, I mean, if you talk about like performance advantage, because she feels like it's cheating, Dragonfly spikes would have probably a far outsized benefit than having like some small levels of nandrolone through your system, like wherever that nandrolone is coming from. And so to me, that feels like that's a big point on behalf of Shelby.
And so we know we don't know shit about this, but I think the overarching feeling I have that I'm just like kind of speculating about is that my guess is that this is connected to maybe anti-doping problems more generally, in that I don't buy the burrito thing necessarily.
I don't think I do.
But either. I think that there's a solid chance that something got contaminated in the supplement chain or the cream chain. I mean, there's theories about there around that.
Whether that's gray area or illegal, so, or where that falls
for those that
in
don't
terms
know,
of like the doping spectrum.
You know, when I was tested, for example, they ask you to list everything you've been taking that isn't just like normal food stuff. And so you list everything there. If you are dishonest on that, if you don't say everything, you're penalized. And if you are honest and the thing you have happens to be contaminated, you're penalized. So the burrito thing probably was the best opportunity to actually race. That being said, like maybe it's 100% true, who knows? But that we wanted to talk about anti-doping complications more generally, because I think they tie back into this case. The big one being contamination. And this is where I have the problem with the current system a little bit. And I think it needs some change.
It's because our current system is so sensitive that we can pick up the smallest and tiniest amounts of these, you know, medications or like compounds or chemicals in people's systems. And it's very hard to trace back.
So every athlete is probably going to argue contamination when they get popped. But the idea is sometimes those contamination cases are true, and those athletes need to have recourse that being honest is fully rewarded and you're not automatically penalized. And the tragic case here, for those that don't know, is triathlete Beth McKenzie. So long story short, she took a salt pill in the context of winning an Ironman, I think Australia or something like that. And her salt pill, which she was able to prove, was contaminated with ostarine,
which is a banned substance.
Which is, I think it's a stimulant of some type, not exactly sure. And it was one of the most heartbreaking things ever. So I remember a few months later, she happened to see us in a grocery store. And after this all came out, she messaged and said, "I was too ashamed to approach you because I thought you would judge me for this situation." And it's like, oh my God, you took a salt pill at Western States this weekend. Everyone's going to be taking salt pills. What if one of them has ostarine? How is that their fault? And she was banned for 2 years. And I mean,
she had no idea. I mean, yeah.
It was pretty much the end of her career.
And I think she had a really beautiful quote about this and why there are so many complications in the anti-doping like system and regulations. She said, "Although I had at least 9 in and out of competition drug tests between 2013 and 2016, I never actually considered a scenario where a test would be positive. So I was very unprepared for what followed. I naively looked at every blood or urine test, not as an inquisition, but an indication that I was good enough to be tested. And I was always proud of myself for being selected because it meant I had arrived. I treated drug testing similarly to airport security, a serious but non-threatening system designed to keep me safe and catch those trying to do wrong. Because I so believed in the system, I was certain that there had been a mistake with my A sample, and that buoyed me through the initial shock of the first few days. I was sure my B would not confirm the A."
Yeah, and it's so sad. I mean, I feel extra connected to her. I remember following her blog when I first got into endurance sports in 2006. She was like .blog.
She's a great writer.
Great writer, great.
Also, she has a company now, Win Republic, and I'm obsessed with
her. So her next chapter has been awesome. She's rocked it in life. But it gets to the point that like, okay, if everyone's going to argue contamination, the problem with someone like Shelby might be, if you are honest, you are still banned.
You're lumped into this category of people who are arguing contamination from like sex and all these other like different places.
Your reputation is still ruined. And so that gets to the point that, you know, excuses can get creative. Daniel Plaza, a race walker, said he ingested nandrolone while giving his pregnant wife oral sex.
Wow.
Because you can get it during pregnancy.
Also another one, so Dennis Mitchell, he claimed he had testosterone from a 6-pack of beer and sex with his wife 4 times. Quote unquote, "It was her birthday. She deserved a treat." I think that's hilarious.
And he was later wrapped up in the Balco scandal, and that turned out not to be true. Also very relevant because he coaches a lot of the top sprinters now. It shows that a lot of these big issues do have tendrils into the future. And it's not just like, we need a system that is not punitive, but still catches the cheats. And that's a very hard problem. So where are the lines drawn? I mean, caffeine is an exogenous substance that improves
performance. Oh my gosh, you can go out and drink, you know, you can drink 4 pots of coffee before you go out and race, and that's fine.
And
that's certainly gray area.
At Western States, people are going to be taking ibuprofen, which could have a major impact, major negative health impacts, but it's not a
certainly,
substance.
Yeah. I mean, we've actually seen some athletes have great results off of ibuprofen. And again, it's like, but I think the other interesting thing about this too, is it's about how the body responds to a drug in so much as it is about the race performance. And I think that's where it becomes very hard to like, say like, what are we actually measuring in sport? And it becomes a fundamental question.
But we absolutely need to answer those questions because there can be a race to the bottom that we see across sports. So talking about baseball again, the performance enhancing drug scandal in baseball happened when it wasn't enforced strongly enough. And it's probably still a problem, but at least it's less less obvious. And the idea with the race to the bottom is if 1,000 evenly matched people, if one of them takes a banned substance, that person might be a champion. As I said last week, the shit rises to the top. And so that becomes a problem because everyone that rises to the top will then face, skepticism. And so how do you design a system that gets rid of some of the skepticism, makes it a clean sport, but then also doesn't catch up like honest athletes and ruin their lives in the process?
It's so hard. Do you think that question, like, how do you even answer that question?
Well, so I think the first place to start in our brief little solutions, which we don't really have, but as a lawyer, is that there needs to have, contingencies for a situation like Beth McKenzie, that her lack of intent and ability to prove the chain of like control absolves her of the ban. That doesn't mean that the results can still get wiped off the slate. But if athletes are afraid of that, like it reads to situations like me where you get drug tested. And even though you just had vitamin D, you're like, oh my God, what if it's contaminated? Because it ruins my life.
You're being anxious for two months. Yeah. And I think the other thing too is like having support for athletes who are actively going through this process. So I think like not jumping on athletes immediately when a decision is made, because we know these decisions now, our testing is so sensitive that we have to wait for all of the facts to be out. And I think like, on that topic too, though, these anti-doping agencies need to be very careful with how they're releasing facts and how they're releasing the evidence, and to make sure they're releasing this full facts.
And more transparency in general. And this goes to the athletes too, that we need to be more open with how we put information out there, because if it's all behind this black curtain, we still don't know what's happened in any of these cases. And that creates a situation where everyone speculates about like me saying that, oh, maybe it was a pill or a cream. It's like, we should know a little bit more as these, if we're going to ruin lives, or on the flip side, if we're going to say the anti-doping system needs to change, maybe it operated absolutely perfectly in this situation.
I think for me too, it comes down to being skeptical of the sport and the system and the process, but also holding compassion for the humans going through that process at the same time.
Yeah, no, I think that that's the key here. It's like the anti-doping is so important, and everyone that is involved in that process, heck yes, each of those, like the people in the labs, the people that take the test, all the volunteers that work for USADA and WADA, like, and even like CAS and all that other stuff, heck yes, it's so essential.
And have faith that they're trying to do their best in this process.
But also,
this is like their job.
Yeah, and also have compassion though for the individual athletes who might view this as like a pass-fail test where their future is on the line. And sometimes, like in the case of Beth McKenzie, it's on the line without them having any intent, any idea of what's happening. And it's like the ultimate human tragedy is possible. And my guess is that if you talk to athletes that go through this process, the ones that actually look at the studies and do start worrying about it can get into anxiety spirals that can get really difficult, but they can't talk about it because of this situation where, if anything ever happens, you are evil. And that's basically
it's
where
so
we
need. Tough.
That's
it's so basically tough. Where we need. I think for me, just this idea gets back to the infamous phrase, like "don't hate the player, hate the game," and I feel like that like applies 100% to the situation.
Yeah. So hopefully we can move forward in a way that like absolves clean athletes or athletes that want to be clean of minor transgressions, but then catches all the people that are trying to cheat. And as that relates specifically to Shelby, we have no fucking clue.
We have no idea.
Yeah.
But we did a lot of research on pork.
Yeah, we did. You want to get to topic one?
Let's do topic one. This is from A. How many athletes are you and Coach Megan coaching at Western States 100? Will you be there? With so many elite racers, and every last one of them are, do you ever feel anxious knowing all the strengths and weaknesses each racer holds? Lastly, when the race is over, you're going to have some athletes who have stellar races and those who have something to go unexpectedly wrong. Is it possibly ecstatic for some and help others with postmortem race blues? Yep, I'm basically asking, how the heck does Team Roach work their magic on race day? I love this question.
It's such a good question. So compassionate. But first, we wanted to zoom out and talk about taper niggles, because a lot of our athletes racing Western States are a microcosm of what we see generally, in that in the 2 weeks before the race, when they back off training, they'll often find themselves getting a little bit beat up and feeling like they're a little bit injured.
And I think it all comes back to, and we're going to frame this in the context of inflammation, of like what is happening to the body on an inflammation level as the body is entering into these taper periods.
Yeah. So as you end a taper, you're at a pretty high level of training. So the underlying inflammation, if we took a blood test of inflammation markers, is rather high. But what changes at the start of the taper? You're starting to remove some of that background cycling of like day to day where, you're a little tired, you wake up, you do your exercise, you get the endorphins, you get your body works through it, you get back to that diurnal cycle. You're just working through it,
I like to contextualize that in the context of like cellular stimuli. You're gifting your body these like cellular stimuli that allows you to adapt and recover when you're not entering into these taper periods.
And sometimes that chronic stress can add up to overstress, which is a really bad thing. But usually in training, you're able to find an equilibrium. At taper, notorious, like inherently you're reaching a little bit of a disequilibrium where you need to back off a little bit. And so that's what happens. And starting a few days after that, often those inflammation numbers are still high. You don't have the benefit of the on-off cycling of the exercise.
The cellular stimuli. Yeah.
So you can start to feel some niggles. Any underlying issues you have exacerbated by the systemic stress.
And maybe not even underlying issues. Like maybe the systemic stress is just causing something entirely new that you're not even doing anything about.
Which is why you'll almost always see these things come and go. Like it's 2 days, it's 1 day, it's 3 days.
It could be like a minor Achilles injury. Yeah. I've seen toe injuries or like toe pain or hip pain. I've often even seen, I think actually sometimes when this like inflammation processes happen, I do think there is some immune system activation. Yes. And so we've seen, I mean, very commonly, actually for me during taper periods, I get sore throats all the time. I'm like, is this allergies? Am I sick? I never get sick. This is super weird. But for me, like sore throat, fatigue, headache, very common during taper.
And then also just the psychology of it. I mean, I always think on a Friday before a long run Saturday, an athlete might be a little bit tired and sore. But if an athlete is tired and sore a whole Friday and a half or a whole week and a half before their race, they're like, why am I tired and sore?
Panicking. Well, I know for me, like the stairs are always kind of like the litmus test for how I'm recovering in life. And like usually I'll just like walk up the stairs, no big deal. I don't think anything about it. The week of a race, I'm analyzing every single stair step. I'm like, are my legs sore? Are things clenching? Does my Achilles hurt? And it's like just like my brain is going on a spiral of thinking and thinking and thinking.
Yeah. And that's why we say usually for tapers, you know how with altitude, they say you get to altitude 2 weeks before your race or 2 days before your race. I think that's more about a taper. For a taper, you're thinking either 2 or 3 days or 2 or 3 weeks. Because if you catch it in that like one bad place where you're starting to get that inflammation settle in, but not quite able to clear it, then you can start having some negative effects. And that gets back to also knowing your body. Really rapid adapters don't need to worry about this at all.
I think this is highly individual.
Yeah.
Also, I think it's really interesting with female athletes with the menstrual cycle. So I've seen that some athletes who have variable menstrual cycles or some athletes whose menstrual cycle is responsive to the training stimuli, sometimes doing a taper will actually induce a period. And that can, and then sometimes that period falls after race day, which means an athlete is in like their the higher hormone phase, like while racing, which can be tough. So I think it's about knowing your body, knowing your menstrual cycle, knowing all of these different components and like, you know, talking with your coach about it and really like developing the
strategy. Trusting the taper. If you have rest niggles, that doesn't mean run through it. Start resting right away. Listen to that signal because that is your body telling you, hey, it might just be good to back off a little bit more. And that's a good thing. We have seen so many breakthrough races from like tapers that are a little all over the place.
That have like 3 rest days.
Yeah, exactly. Taper.
Actually, I did a race in 2016 where I was feeling some knee pain before 50K, took 3 days off, ran the day before the race, and then had a great 50K race. And
yeah, you absolutely
rocked
it. It was
a very unconventional taper, but it worked.
Yeah. So on to Western States. This is the ultimate party of the year, but I think for us, it comes with a lot of anxiety. I mean,
we have a lot going on coming up in the coming. I actually have a research project at Western States too. We got athletes coaching, but we're pumped about it.
Yeah, well, we care about these athletes so damn much. They're some of our closest friends in most instances, but you also get so invested in it and that it can be uncertain for us, just like it can be for them, that we really can dial in a lot of things and have a great idea of where the good days lie. But the bad days are the bad days, no matter what.
I think it gets to the idea that like, and I've used this phrase a ton, that like with ultra racing, you're just like rolling your dice with variables so that you're going to have this like range of probabilities of things that could happen on race day, a range of probabilities of the outcome. Like if we created a computer simulation of all the different outcomes that could occur at Western States, we're going to have dots all over the place.
Yeah.
I mean, there may be dots in someone winning the race to DNFing and like everything in between.
It's like the game Plinko where the thing just drops down in price of right. And sometimes it ends up on one side and sometimes it ends up on the other. It's nothing to do with initial conditions, really. It just is kind of random variation. And that's kind of what I try to convey to athletes is that often the 10% outcome happens. That could be the race of someone's life, or it could be the worst race of their life. Either way, that doesn't mean that it was predestined. It means that it was a 10% outcome. And so we're trying to make it so that, you know, the 50% outcome gets pointed a little higher. And even the 25%, like all the negative ones start to get pointed a little higher, but you can't control the bad shit that is going to happen in an ultra.
And I think in terms of like, how do you actually coach that? I think what we try to do is like accurately convey that, yes, this is a range of probabilities. But as we look at this range of probabilities, as we look at like what this computer simulation is going to shoot out with like Plinko points all over the point is believe through all of that. Because like, actually there's a quote that I love by Osho, be realistic, plan for a miracle. And I feel like that's what we tell our athletes.
Yeah, be realistic, plan for a miracle. And to put this into practice, so I was talking to John Kelly about his sleep plans for an upcoming 6-day big Wainwright's FKT attempt. And I was telling him, look, John, we just want to avoid the bottom third of potential outcomes because you are so fit and so fast and you've controlled everything you can control that as long as we can do that, the top two thirds, all amazing. And so I was like, sleep more. It might leave a few hours on the table, but that's worth it. We'll see exactly what he does. I have a feeling he might not take that advice because he's a gambling man who knows his probabilities.
I love that. But I think actually the final point that I would like to say on this topic too is that like as you look at this range of probabilities, like you, if you're racing enough 100Ks, hundreds, like these like long ultra races, you may have a few points that are a little bit lower in terms of like, you know, DNFs or just like tough days. And just because you have a sequence of those doesn't mean that's like your inevitable future. It doesn't mean that's your trajectory. It's just what rolled out. And like that doesn't predict, that doesn't always predict. I think sometimes it is important to look at like, you know, trends and trajectories, but that doesn't always predict what's coming next.
Yeah. And that the next one is going to be the one where you're be realistic, plan for a miracle.
Where
and
you then shoot
the
next shot,
one. Yeah. And then just gets, it's like the Olympic trials, you know, the sands of time go on, you know, in the face of that uncertain future that we can't really control. And there's always going to be bad days. Just always come back to love and like hope and compassion for yourself, but also for the other racers that are going through the same thing.
I love that so much. I think that's a great place to end, kick it off.
So we love you all. Yeah. This is
amazing. Rate, subscribe, review, whatever you do to podcasts. I'm going to make David cringe here at the end and say, happy freaking birthday, boo. I love you. You are the best. And I really hope it's a magical rest of the day.
I love you so much. Don't make me do a smoothie again.
No more smoothie gate.
We love you all.
Bye.